Have you heard the saying, if it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck?
I've heard it as if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, but yeah.
Walks and quacks, yeah. It basically means that if something looks, sounds, or behaves like a certain thing, it's likely to be that thing. And people often use this expression when they're not sure about the true nature or identity of something or someone.
Yep.
For example, if someone acts like a criminal, people might assume that they are one, even if they haven't been proven guilty yet. But the expression is also a warning against making quick judgments based on appearances only.
Wait, is it a warning? It sounds like an encouragement.
It does sound like an encouragement, doesn't it? It encourages us to take a closer look and evaluate evidence carefully before we make any conclusions. I read it the same way as you, that it's basically saying you can jump to conclusions. But in principle, it seems to be the opposite.
I think the other thing is that the interesting thing is that I've always taken it to have an ability to convey something a little deeper, right? Which is that, like, it's not just saying, if it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck, means that, like, oh, it's probably the thing. I've also kind of taken it to mean, for all intents and purposes, it is that thing. And that leads...
But what is it truly to be a duck?
Exactly. Well, this
look at all those chickens.
Look at all those chickens. This is what leads us on to today's episode about AI and understanding. And the question is, if functionally you perfectly mimic understanding, are you effectively understanding? Is there a distinction worth making? If you walk like a duck and quack like a duck, even if you aren't a duck, for all intents and purposes, are you a duck?
Welcome, guys, to the Morality of Everyday Things. I'm Jacob.
I'm Ant. I'll go. This is a podcast about morality and philosophy. Maybe someone share this with you. Thank you. Please do leave a review on Spotify and Apple. We're missing the love on Apple. Let's jump straight in. Today's episode, we're talking about AI and understanding. I'll use a thought experiment to highlight this in a second, but part of what sparked this was that I was at a meeting in our office recently.
And what happened in the meeting?
A duck quacked. and everyone was like, what was that? And I was like, probably a duck. No.
They're like, no, it's ChatGPT.
workspace is connected to a university, and there's a bunch of people from the university, and it's about some government grant scheme where they get researchers into businesses. And one guy was a therapist, and he's saying, oh, you know, we're looking for AI helping therapists, blah blah blah. And you know, they were talking about whether AIs are empathetic, and ML machine learning experts like, oh, you know, AIs aren't empathetic, blah blah blah. And it's funny because they were saying that, having the discussion, and they were talking about the limitations of AI in therapy. A lot of them were limitations. I was like, these will be overcome pretty soon. But it's funny because that one person saying AIs are obviously not empathetic, it's funny because in one sense that's obviously true.
Mm-hmm.
They never are. But in another, they're so trainable and adaptable. And the rate of improvement of ChatGPT, as an example, all AIs, is so much faster than most people, mm-hmm. and doesn't have the limitations of people. And the ceiling's actually higher. At some point, if you can tune the algorithm well, can they not at least mimic empathy perfectly? And this is the other thing, not just perfectly. Maybe as a therapist, maybe they can do it better than a therapist.
Because they don't have the limitations of regular therapists, which are ultimately human and fallible. And
exactly. Your therapist could be going through a divorce and be thinking, Jesus, shut up. I have my own problems. I don't want to be here. I need medication, whatever else, right? And it kind of starts to, there's two points. Like, one, is AI understanding? What is understanding? That's part of what we'll discuss. Mm. And then two, at what point is perfectly mimicking something
the same as the actual thing
itself? Yeah, the same as being the thing. Because this is another fundamental human problem, right? That we'll kind of touch on, but maybe could be its own episode.
Mm.
You know, we kind of have thinking, feeling experiences, and, you know, we know what thinking, feeling is, but it's hard to explain, like, I felt mm-hmm. something. What is that? Like, I experienced it. It gave me sensations, right?
I was just hungry.
I mean, this is the classic thing. Like, as far as we're concerned, everyone else is just AIs. There are inputs, and then they respond to those stimuli in predictable ways. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, I don't know that everyone else is actually feeling things and aren't. I don't know that animals are feeling things, and it's not something that's provable. Mm-hmm. And even then, the fact that I, quote unquote, experience something negative, is that different to just, like, a negative parameter in the programming of my functionality?
Zero instead of a one.
Is the fact that these machines are made out of metal and silicon rather than flesh, carbon-based flesh and blood, like, does that mean that the fact that they just are machines that respond to stimuli, does that make them different? How do we draw the distinction between an AI that can understand perhaps even better than humans in some metrics and humans themselves? That's today's question.
Yeah, and it's mad because you do see stories about this in the news, particularly with the explosion of ChatGPT. You guys have probably picked up in references on previous episodes. It's a product that we're big fans of. We found it super useful as a tool in our work, but it's gone further than that in the sense that you've got people falling in love with ChatGPT and having what they consider almost relationships with it, because they're like, wow, it really understands
me. There
was
that Google engineer who was saying these things. Right?
He said it was sentient, didn't he? He said Lambda was actually conscious because its responses were so good.
We're going to jump onto this. What does it mean to understand? There's a great thought experiment that highlights this from a philosopher called John Searle. You may have heard of it. It's called Chinese Room Experiment. But first, I just want to really quickly touch on the economic impacts, because I think that's part of, we were asked by some listeners, particularly Christian on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
We knew him through one of the hiring platforms we used. Hi.
Hi, Christian.
We want to quickly just touch on the economic impacts, because I think that's what a lot of what people mean when they say, like, oh, ChatGPT, how is it going to impact people?
This will merit a whole episode in itself, probably. Yeah.
And we'll probably look at it.
Acknowledging, for sure.
Yeah. So I think there's two or three things that I want to say on AI on both sides, right? And I'm saying this as someone who uses it and was using it yesterday to actually, for the first time in ages, do some programming. And I was never a great programmer, right?
I can confirm.
Yes. But to actually build some tools with it, right? And I think the one thing that we found really quickly is that it empowers you. You move so quickly, but it doesn't replace you.
Well, this is the thing. My impression of using it so far has been it's a really powerful tool. And actually, let's use the example of like copywriting, because it's an easy way to make the point. AI writes copy so fast and so efficiently, and you can regenerate responses, train prompts, just get better and better at this stuff until you get really good articles. Yep. So it replaces the grunt work of writing literal text.
Exactly.
However, you still need an editor. You still need curating. You still need someone with the eye.
You need to decide what you're writing and why. To be really specific in copywriting, say, for example, you want to do a landing page for a blog, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I found is if you say, write a blog on X, it gives you a pretty bad response, right?
Yeah.
But if you understand, these are the things I need to hit,
mm-hmm.
this is the length I need it to be, et cetera, and then you actually break it down where, like, it's, you know, for example, writing paragraphs that you've given quite specific prompts where it's like, I need you to write about this for a paragraph. I need you to include these themes and have it with this tone, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of, you're using it as a tool. It's doing the grunt work. It's the same with programming, right? The way that I found is like, you can't say at a high level, hey, make me a technology business, right? You need to break the stuff down really specifically. Like, I need to write a script that does this function with these requirements in this language, and I'm going to put it in this place. So write it appropriately. And that requires understanding. And also the more fundamental understanding of like, why am I doing this at all?
It requires ideas. It requires...
Yeah, exactly.
It empowers you to be more strategic in your work, is my impression so
exactly.
far.
All of this that we're talking about, the reason I want to do the economic stuff first is because this is a really good explanation of how AI empowers but doesn't replace. That helps to explain the way or the difference between AI, quote unquote, understanding and actual understanding. But don't get me wrong, soon the AI understanding is going to be so good and powerful. I see a horizon fairly close where, to take an example of us making this podcast, I can use ChatGPT to help me do my scripting and research faster. The world where like it then has an AI voice writes a nuanced script that's funny and then reads the script, that's less than a decade away, I would guess.
Which is scary.
But as it stands for now, there's still a place for you and me.
Yeah, let's hope, because then otherwise, you've got an AI that has even nicer sounding voices.
Exactly.
It's funnier. Oh my God.
The second thing I want to jump on really quickly is people are like, oh, well, you know, increased productivity, or are we going to be working less? I think my immediate reaction to that is that we have said this since the Industrial Revolution, right? And the actual outcome is that, like, the prospect of increased returns on the horizon means that we tend to work harder because we use the tools that make us more productive. Instead of saying this is the acceptable level of productivity, the goalposts just shift. And it's like, okay, now this is the acceptable. So basically, it used to be like, you know, back in the day, it would be like, hey, if you're a programmer, put out, I don't know, took a year to make your website, you'd be like, wow, you know, no one makes websites. This is amazing. And then at some point, you know, in the last 10 years, it was like, mate, we need to be shipping every day. Like, new features need to go live every day. And now it's going to be like, if you're not shipping, I'm using arbitrary signposts, but you know, I mean,
Law of accelerated returns, right?
The point is
every
just
hour
that
it could be.
Yeah. You'll expect more from your developers. And maybe there'll be a little bit of a trade off where it's like, oh, you know, like the bar for like having it worth having developers. But my overall impression is like, we've said this with all productivity shifts and it hasn't happened. Instead, we've just expected more of people to use these tools. However, and this is my counterpoint three, maybe this is different. And the big thing I want to talk about is transport.
Transport? Why transport?
Well, ChatGPT doesn't change this, but AI, it's still relevant, right?
In terms of self-driving cars, is that where you're going?
So this is one where there are some tasks, like driving, and certain office-based tasks as well, where like the creative human sort of understanding, again, we'll talk about that in a minute, isn't as needed, right? Like driving, the technology for the cars to simply drive themselves exists. It's really a PR and policy thing that's stopping it being mainstream at this point. And this isn't like previous shift where it's like, oh, we got rid of typists, like whatever, they retrain or whatever. We're talking about like one of the top five sources of employment in the world for all people. We're talking about low-skilled labor and we're talking about it suddenly disappearing, and that can cause huge social
disruption. You're talking about things like taxis, freight,
all flights.
Yeah,
I mean, don't worry, they'll get transition periods, but like, you know, they're gonna want to slowly down phase them out and pay these people less and less as the requirement for them to have certain skills is lower and lower. This is all things, but I thought the first two points were really particularly interesting to the concept of understanding, and those tasks are ones that don't require the human kind of understanding. I just wanted to highlight that. Maybe we'll do a separate episode on it.
That's probably one to come up in the future.
Let's talk about understanding.
And the best place to begin is, you mentioned John Searle's thought experiment. Tell us about the Chinese room thought experiment.
Right, okay. So this is a thought experiment by John Searle. He came up with this thought experiment in the 1980s. It's really just a way of highlighting the way way that computers understand things. And you can use this analogy to kind of think through certain problems and be like, oh, okay, like they're not really understanding, they're just getting the outputs right.
Well, it's funny to think, because back then when computers were so good at things just like maths, people were like,
computation.
Well, yeah, exactly, literally computation, where you have the, I mean, AI obviously existed as a concept then too, but
actually the main limitation wasn't the mathematical understanding of the stuff that we use. Mm. Although now backward propagating models and things like that's different, but like machine learning particularly, we had the understanding, we didn't have the computational power.
We didn't, exactly. But people, even just looking at the way computers did math so fast, were like, whoa, can these things think?
Yeah.
And this was really in response to that, and where kind of people thought AI was going to go was just like...
I think the interesting thing is I read that book Code by Charles Petzold.
Yeah. Right?
And it just reminds you...
Good book until like the last third where it's really dense.
I think was it Steve Jobs who said like good technology, good products feel like magic or something like that? Mm-hmm. That's how ChatGPT feels. But then when you read that book, it just kind of reminds you that like computers are actually just incredibly intricate, like Rube Goldberg machines. And it's just amazing that we make them. But like that... Anyway, I recommend that book. Or at least some basic understanding of like how binary switches and silicon chips and stuff work, just to kind of cement yourself and like understand like, oh wow, that's how many like ones and zeros are happening really quick to convey information.
The fact that it all runs off binary when you get things so complicated as we have with AI now, it still blows my mind.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Think about streaming an HD video.
Mm-hmm.
How much information is coming so quickly that it's just every pixel and it's just one of a few light, like it's first of all on and off, and secondly one of a few color options, right? And that makes HD movies, and then every movie is just tons of frames really quick. Like think about the amount of ones and zeros
so
that need to come to do that.
It's mental.
It's like, it's also crazy to think that like every novel in existence, this is trivial, it's obviously true, but can be broken down into ones and zeros. It's just the right combination of them makes Moby Dick.
Absolutely mad. Anyway, tangent. So back to the Chinese room.
So in this experiment, a person, the quote-unquote man in the room, who does not speak or understand Chinese, is placed in a room with a set of rules written for him in English that allow him to manipulate Chinese characters. The person is given a set of Chinese characters, inputs, and according to the rules he follows, he produces other Chinese characters' outputs. From the perspective of someone outside the room who does not know what is happening inside, it may seem as if the person inside the room understands Chinese. So the way that this would work is that, like, you know, he has a dictionary or some rules written down for him, you know, you can reference in the table, and someone will, you know, slip in a Chinese character to him, say, for example, how are you? And he'll see that the response to give is, I am fine. And he doesn't understand this. He's just seeing like random lines and symbols. Mm-hmm. And it's like arrow, these random lines and symbols. And he grabs that and he puts it back under the door.
It's effectively a lookup table. So
exactly.
It's just saying this equals this. So he can take that, produce that.
This is a super simplified way of saying, because obviously, you know, complex AI is more than just lookup tables, but it's kind of, the point he's making is that that is effectively what a computer is doing, right? It's not like the guy in the room may, to external people, seem to understand Chinese, but clearly he doesn't.
Yeah.
Is the point he's making here. He argues that despite the appearance of understanding, they're simply following a set of rules without comprehending their meaning, or, you know, in a kind of deeper level, why they were given those rules or why they should follow rules.
Well, this is it. And it's like when you give a computer a sum, to take the sort of 1980s computing example, it could look like the computer understands maths, but all it's doing actually is following a set of rules. But isn't that what we all do when we just do maths?
Exactly.
Wait a second.
Well, this is the fundamental. I think too many people put this like special place for humans and they kind of don't realize that this is what understanding is anyway. His argument is often used as a critique of the idea that artificial intelligence can truly replicate human intelligence and that true understanding and consciousness can't really be reduced to algorithms and rules, which, like I said, I kind of disagree with that, because, like, say for example, nuance, how do you learn nuance? You learn it by being given examples of how to use it, and you just learn that it's the rules of communicating. However, the question that immediately follows is, okay, if we agree that that isn't understanding, but they are perfectly replicating the expected response, then how can we define understanding in a way that rules out this man in the room?
Which is a really complicated question. There's two different types of understanding that philosophers have designed to try and answer this. So we can talk about those in a bit. Functional understanding and phenomenal understanding. And this will kind of drive it, like we'll probably explore a little bit how AI works and how it's different to the way that humans work. And maybe, as you say, maybe we just give too much credit to human intelligence, but human intelligence works in complicated ways, whereas AI intelligence
works in predictable
ways. Quite predictable ways. But yeah.
Sort of. To the extent you can get to the extent. One, so far. Two, to the extent that you can get your head around a huge data sets.
Things like deep learning and neural networks. Functional understanding. What is that? It refers to the ability to perform a task or produce a correct response. So in the case of the Chinese room experiment,
this is the type of understanding it's showing. Right?
He doesn't know what's going on, but he can take an input and produce the right output. And it looks, for all external purposes, like there is understanding going on. And that's the kind that people typically associate with AI and machine learning, because they're saying computers don't understand what's going on, but they can take the input and produce the right output.
So this is the not useful description of understanding where, like, well, you know, that's just what you've included this and that. So the part that is not related to the man in the Chinese room, the one that he doesn't seem to be actually possess, is what we would call phenomenal understanding.
So what is that?
So this involves a deeper level of comprehension and meaning, and it goes beyond mere functionality, right? Mm-hmm. It involves the ability to grasp the significance and context of that information, and hence make connections between ideas, and to draw inferences based on prior knowledge, experience. And this type of understanding is what we tend to associate with human consciousness.
Let me give you an example with the Chinese room analogy. This would be the guy receives a symbol that isn't in his lookup table.
Yeah.
Functional understanding breaks down at this point because he can't return the correct response.
Yeah.
But whereas if he had phenomenal understanding, he could presumably have learned or you know, he could understand the symbol or grasp the significance from what else he's learned.
Or here's something like he could see that it's similar to another symbol, but in a way that doesn't follow the rules and give a suggested answer. Or you say you are a human in that room, you could draw a big question mark and slide it back under and understand that the person on the other side will then take that as a response of, I don't know, right? That's the limit of the understanding. Now, the problem is anytime that you have that sort of answer, it's like, well, we can just make rules to cover that, can't we?
So AI can do that. Yeah. ChatGPT will often give in response to sort of incorrect questions or spelling errors. So this is funny. We'll maybe talk about Moravec's paradox later. This is something I've only heard, I've never written. So I was writing Moravec and spelling it wrong, and ChatGPT kept telling me, I don't understand what this is. Can you rephrase your question to
hey, idiot? We're kind of disagreeing with this here, but I think the point is that a lot of philosophers will say that phenomenal understanding is a prerequisite for truly understanding, and it cannot be reduced to functional understanding alone. They'll argue that fundamental difference between producing the correct response and actually grasping the meaning and significance of that response is what is encapsulated in the phenomenal understanding. So in the Chinese room experiment, the person inside the room may be able to produce the correct response, but without that phenomenal understanding, they're not really able to deal with, as we said, anything outside of the expected parameters. And that means that they're not actually understanding what they're given. I don't know if that's the measure, but clearly, like, they're not actually understanding. So one way of understanding this is that responding to stimuli is different to the conscious experience, which can organically and spontaneously create outputs without the prompts. This is the other thing that's relevant to ChatGPT, right? And this is part of the reason
that it's reactive,
right? It responds to prompts, and it depends on the prompts also following the rules. Whereas a person, I can say anything to a person and they can say anything back, right?
And they can say stuff to you without you can say stuff to you without you having said something to them in the first place. They can
Well, this is the more fundamental thing. It's understanding the why, like, why am I putting in a prompt at all? Why am I trying to achieve anything at all? Those are kind of like higher level thoughts that the AI simply doesn't have or can't
yet.
Well, this is the other thing that we kind of touched on a minute ago, like, what happens when, you know, every time that you're just getting more and more of these edge cases? One, how do humans deal with this experience?
And therefore, we can create rules. And there,
are we just a more advanced machine that can come up with more creative solutions to how to deal with this? What if we showed an AI examples of how to deal with not understanding something, which is exactly what it does? It doesn't give the exact same mark, like, error. It says, you know, sorry, can you rephrase this? Or this doesn't make sense. Or this is beyond my capabilities, right? It reflects some understanding. And yeah, ultimately, are we just giving people too much credit? Are people really just really, really good functional understanders to the extent that it starts to look like phenomenal understanding, but really phenomenal understanding isn't a thing and doesn't exist?
As a bigger question, maybe we are just extremely complicated AIs ourselves built on, like, biochemical interactions.
Eyes.
Which is
eyes.
We're a collection of organic atoms, and chemicals kind of replace the electrical circuitry that machines built on. But
this is it. I mean, the fundamental point is that the AI is going to get to a point pretty soon where, by all measures, it's actually more understanding than us, even however it is that you try to define these phenomenal understandings. Because, okay, say for example, part of it is spontaneity and putting in the prompt. These are just layers on top of it, where it's like, you know, come up with a new prompt, a random prompt, or a prompt based on,
and then answer it yourself.
And then also, like, but the why, it's like, well, you know, people struggle to find their quote unquote purpose or meaning in life. Mm. But like you could even put that as a prompt in your algorithm. Like,
what is my purpose?
You have some unknown meaning. You're trying to find that meaning and you're optimizing towards it. You come up with a random prompt every half a second, right?
Yeah.
Like, at what point are you replicating even the phenomenal understanding so well? The fact that we have spontaneity, I think, is really not a hard limitation to overcome.
Here's a controversial opinion. I think a lot of the time, part of what humans like to use to distinguish themselves in their form of intelligence from even animals, but certainly from machines, is emotional intelligence and the ability to understand emotional reasoning and react to situations and all these things and have that be part of our sort of memory and our learning. And I sometimes wonder if actually we just give way too much credit to emotion as a form of learning and intelligence, because actually emotion is really just the product of like millennia of evolution. And it's ultimately just hormonal
and also your entire upbringing yourself as well, which another limitation, by the way, to bear in mind. We die and we can only take in so much information per second, even if it's not biological or, you know, quote unquote conscious. The AI has the advantage of all of human history and can like take in more and doesn't die, so it can keep getting better.
Its processing power just continues to improve, whereas it's hard. I mean, in a sense, we could say we invest in our own processing power through education.
Yeah. This comes back to the thing I said at the beginning, Serge, that you were talking about people, animals, machines. Machines are metal, not strictly, but you know what I mean. Animals, humans are all biological. We assume, you know, say for example, cats, dogs have feelings because they act like they do. I can tell an AI to act like it does. And the only real, you know, at some point, the only real distinction is going to be that one is metal and I can turn it off and the other is a living being. Also, I can also turn it off. I just can't turn it back on again.
Oh God.
But yeah, like the only reason that we suddenly are like, well, other people, it's like, well, I know that I'm a human and I have feelings and they seem to react to stimuli, so I'm assuming they have feelings. Mm. But say, for example, insects and stuff, right? There is no better reason to think that an insect has feelings versus an AI other than the fact that it's made of biological material. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's literally it.
Yeah, because there's a lot of stimuli that it doesn't respond to in the way that AIs do better. You can't talk to an insect.
And an AI can tell you, well, I mean, you know, it has to be told that, hey, there's this negative function, but like, how do I know its response to a negative function isn't it, quote unquote, feeling negative? Mm. Like, when I am in pain, like, it's hard to describe. It's an experience I have that's negative, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you can tell an AI that they can have that. And you can tell an AI part of, you know, being you is that you now express pain or misery when you are given negative inputs. Oh, it's difficult.
It's crazy, isn't it? There's a couple of concepts we could introduce that are relevant here. We've got the Turing test and we've got Moravec's paradox.
I have a great story on the Turing test. You go first.
Well, I was just going to define the Turing test really quickly. So I'll define it, then you tell your story. The Turing test is basically a test of a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior. And how close is that to mimicking a human? So it's named after the British mathematician and computer scientist Alan Turing, of course. He proposed it in a 1950 paper titled Computing Machinery and Intelligence. And basically, it just says, if a human engages in natural language conversations with a human and a machine, it couldn't tell the difference. Something passes the Turing test if its responses pass for human responses, if it couldn't tell the difference between which one's the machine and which one's the human. And it's a significant milestone in the field of AI. It's been the subject of much debate and research. One thing I suppose it's important to add to the definition is that if a machine passes the Turing test, it doesn't necessarily mean it's achieved consciousness.
So this is two or three stories here, okay? Without using even machine learning, I listened to a great podcast on this, and two things. One, sex and insults. People can talk to a chatbot, not realize it's a chatbot for ages if you tap into really a human failing the Turing test rather than the bot succeeding it, which is if you get the chatbot to just kind of come back to like a preset, you know, 100 sexual advances, like, oh baby, I think you're so hot or whatever. Yeah, tell me more, stuff like that. Like, people can talk to these things for 10, 15, 20, half an hour, 2 hours, not realize that they're bots. And then likewise, if it's just insulting you, because often that doesn't really need a sophisticated logic, just like, hey, you're a beep, you know, whatever else. Like, people respond like, no, you are. So
you're lots enormously of fat.
Yeah, exactly.
Good reference to the Roald Dahl episode.
So that's one thing. Two, specific story. One of the guys who ran the Turing test, right? Can't remember what it was, but he was like having a correspondence dating thing with a woman in Ukraine or something. Long ago, decades ago, right? But he was a professor in California somewhere. Goes on for ages and it's just not really going anywhere. An embarrassingly long time, like months, right? And then at some point he like writes something, he has a thought, he writes something random and he gets a response that doesn't suggest like, why on earth did you send me something random? And he was like, oh my God, it's a bot. So the guy running the Turing test, like the international event where they do it every year.
And also now,
another thing, now with ChatGPT and Turing test, it's kind of trivial that the machines can now pass this.
Let me tell you quickly about Moravec's paradox, because that's an interesting description of where we are and then we'll wrap up. It's a phenomenon named after computer scientist Hans Moravec, but it basically says, contrary to what one might expect. The tasks that are easy for humans to perform, such as recognizing faces or walking and stuff like that, they're really difficult for computers. Meanwhile, tasks that are difficult for humans, such as complex mathematical calculations and data analysis, are easy for computers. A really interesting sort of interpretation of why Moravec's paradox isn't really a paradox. It's just that the things that humans find hard, they've studied, and it's to do with logic and reason, and that's why
it's also to do with solving problems.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why when we've built computers, we're quite aware of how those things work, and we've invested a lot of effort into them. And computers have the capacity to do really well with those. Whereas the things that we take for granted, like recognizing faces or walking, our own understanding of how we do that isn't actually that sophisticated because so much of it is so subconscious. But as neuroscience
develops,
also
means we have less need to
understand it. But as neuroscience develops, and there's a really interesting feedback loop between how neuroscience is evolving and how AI is evolving, AI probably will get a lot better at these things too.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that they say about like deep learning and back propagating models and stuff, where it's like it more replicates how the brain works.
Yeah, exactly. But that's another interesting one for just like things like understanding and this concept of like, can AI really understand? Because there are so many things that we take for granted that form part of our understanding of the world that we still need to model in AI for it to even functionally understand those things.
I think that was a really good summary. I think we highlighted how, you know, the distinction between human and AI understanding, to the extent that it exists now, and maybe it won't exist in the future. Maybe we're putting humans in an unnecessary special place, and we're just actually really, really good intelligence models that have experience and inputs. So for example, some people say like, oh, AI struggle with humor and emotional intelligence and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I think one of the scary things is if you talk to ChatGPT now, ask it to write jokes. It can write jokes that are as good as an average joke writer's or mediocre joke writer's. You ask it for emotional intelligence, like it can replicate it now. These are just examples of things that it used to struggle with, but increasingly with large language models and large data sets, it's getting better at. Granted, it's just copying how humans do it, but like we said at the beginning, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, for all intents and purposes, one, maybe it is a duck, and two, if it isn't, like, does it matter? We should still treat it as a duck.
My two concluding thoughts. One would be, I feel like for now we're basically saying AI only really has functional understanding, not phenomenal. But the question mark there is, does phenomenal understanding really exist at all? Or is this just phenomenal us giving too much credit?
Yeah, is phenomenal understanding just layers of more functional understanding? You're just finding situations where the functional understanding fails, and then it's like, well, just make the rules to deal with that failing.
Evolve the model.
The same way that humans, you know, actually can also have that problem, and then they just deal with it.
But this is what scares me. My second point is just, I wonder how quickly this episode will be outdated by the rapid acceleration of this technology.
Exactly.
And, you know, in 5-10 years' time, if we're still going and we replay this and we haven't been
taken over by our AI overlords,
then maybe this will seem horribly out of date because of how quickly the technology is advancing.
Although at the same time, the AI will probably never spontaneously develop a why. It can take one, you can give it one, but absent being given one, it probably won't spontaneously be like, well, I want to be happy or whatever that is, right? Or I want to maximize positive inputs for me and all other AIs. Anyway, guys, we got to roll. Thank you very much. Remember, if you enjoyed this, review it. Also, feel free to share with your friends. I say feel free, please share with your friends. It's the best way to grow the pod.
And please tell us if you do debate these questions in your own lives. Tell us what conclusions you come to. We really love interacting with people. We've had so many more responses recently and discussions with people.
That's another thing.
Questions we've had.
Our hot take episodes, we will at least talk about briefly. The best ones or the ones we find most interesting or people like most will turn into full episodes. We will respond to your suggestions if you just message me on LinkedIn, message us on Instagram, email us.
Jacob@Stasher. Feel free to book chats with us through the form and fill in the survey.
Okay.
Thank you so much, guys.
Speak soon, guys.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.